it's an overused phrase, but you know, there's no opportunity like a crisis. It's absolutely true. When everything gets thrown up in the air, then things can be done differently. There is a chance before they settle back into round pegs and round holes and square pegs and square holes to rethink things.
Hi, welcome to the Save As podcast, a conversation with the everyday designers behind iconic brands. I'm your host, Kay Funk, and these are the stories and ideas from the builders that define the products you love. Today on Save As, I have the pleasure of speaking with the longtime industry veteran and sustainability expert, Pete Lankford. Throughout his extensive career, Pete has been on a mission to create better, more sustainable footwear. In his 21-year tenure with Timberland, Pete helped bring to life the Timberland Earthkeepers brand. Now, as an expert in the next wave of sustainable design, Pete has teamed up with a member of the Timberland family, Noah Schwartz, to pioneer a fully circular footwear brand, Arum. Today's episode is a part one, where Pete will be discussing everything that led him up to his work on Arum. But be sure to come back for part two, after the brand launches, to hear the amazing things they have accomplished in sustainable design.
Hey, Pete, welcome to the show.
All right, fine. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, totally. So I guess just kicking right into our first question, if you want to tell me a little bit about yourself, who you are, where you're from.
Sure. Boy, hard to say exactly how wide and broad I'll do this, but I'm originally from Houston, Texas. I was born there long before you were, and I grew up in a just very basic suburban neighborhood, played with my friends in the street. And when I was 8, my family picked up and moved to Mexico City. My father's job took us there, and we spent a year there before I moved up to New England. I settled in New York State, near New York City.
Okay.
And I guess what shaped my childhood is that my father was a scientist and a really brilliant man. He was a World War II generation, grew up, went to college on the GI Bill, went through the Great Depression, and came out of that teaching oceanography. And my point about that is that growing up, science was just, it was just what we swam in. It was how you viewed the world. And so my father would always be observing, posing rhetorical questions to us, like, well, why do you think that is? What's going on here? And that sort of inquiry, observation of the world around you, inbred curiosity about why things are the way they are, really took root in me, as it did with all my siblings. So as an adult, and even as a kid, when my friends were not at all like that, it seemed odd. It simply underscored the fact that I was taking a little bit different path than some of my friends in my neighborhood.
Yeah.
But I would say it served me well. When I went to college, I went to college with the intention of being an architect.
That is a really strong theme on the show.
Is it?
Wow. Yeah.
Well, I didn't know about industrial design at the time. I don't know why the question ever occurred to me that there must be training and people behind all the things that we own and use. But architecture was probably the best fit between how I grew up. I always loved inventing things, coming up with ideas, being really clever with creating something. As a kid, that had a lot more to do with things like tree houses or slingshots or, you know, water balloon launchers or taking balsa wood airplanes, taping bottle rocket engines to them and seeing how far they go, you know.
Yeah.
So when I got to considering college, architecture seemed to be the best known fit. Allowed me to be creative. I love the idea of creating real things.
Yeah.
But about halfway through it, I realized architecture was not a good fit. And so I finished off my first degree in the sciences, in geology, believe it or not.
Oh, cool.
Yes. And then I went back and I got a degree in industrial design when I found out what industrial design was.
Totally.
So it's a long winding road around, and I got used to people at Thanksgiving ask me, when are you ever going to graduate from college? Do you really plan to start your life sometime, or are you just going to be a student? But when I graduated from college I graduated from Syracuse University in New York State, and they happen to have a very strong industrial design program.
Yeah. We've had another Syracuse grad.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh good. Yeah, there's probably 6 or 8 schools in the U.S. that are really known for their design programs, whether they have just been established for a long time or just particularly good at what they do. But I guess what the design program at Syracuse did a good job of doing was teaching you how to think critically and creatively. So why not, and then how, and then back again, and being able to shift left to right brain, as it were, fluidly, very quickly.
Yeah.
And that foundation in thinking, that skill set, stood me well in my career. It meant that I approached design from, I didn't end up in design reviews saying, I think this design is really sweet. Right. I think it's just cool. I had to give it a foundation of backing. It made me think harder about, why are we doing this thing? So a lot of left brain activity that acted as a framework for right brain thinking. So I guess I graduated from college in 1992 in the middle of a recession and didn't know what I was going to do with my degree, but I found my way to Boston mainly because I had friends who lived here who put me up on their couch. And I ended up working as a model maker for a year and a half for a design consultancy that used to be called Design Continuum and is now just called Continuum.
Yeah.
Turned out one of the founders, Gianfranco Zakai, was a Syracuse graduate, and that helped a little bit. But it was probably the best year and a half I can imagine. It taught me how to realize ideas in 3D very quickly. In other words, to sketch in 3D, you might say. And it was all about clever problem solving. How do we create maquettes of golf club putters very quickly that could be modified and played with by the designer who had asked us to do the work? Or, you know, how do you carve a specific profile shape into wren-shaped material, which is a modeling material, without having the right specific tools? How did you just figure it out?
Yeah.
So it was great fun. It was exciting. I got to rub elbows with a lot of the designers up and down the line within the company. And as I said, probably the most valuable thing it taught me was how to sketch in 3D quickly.
Yeah.
And I always argue, we'll get to talking about tools and technology, but I always argue that things like virtual design, while they're beautiful and fascinating, et cetera, eventually you have to make something in 3 dimensions. That's what we do. We sell real things. We're not Silicon Valley creating a digital product. We create right. something real that has an intimate relationship with the user, that where fit and flex, you might say, just the feel of the product are ultimately what compels a person to buy it or not buy it. And yeah. the sooner you get to 3D and test your assumptions that may look nice as pixels, the better off you are. So I found that being able to go to the model shop at Timberland, where I spent the bulk of my career, was essential, that I found I could go and try out things very, very quickly there. So I started at Design Continuum as a model maker. And left there to do some work with a biomechanics, foot biomechanics and design firm in New Hampshire called Exeter Research. And it happened to be run by the former head of R&D of Nike. Nike used to be located in New Hampshire. So Nike Air was created 10 miles from here. In fact, the man I worked for was part of the team that created that. They moved to Beaverton a number of years later. He loved New England. He didn't want to move there. So he stayed here and started his own firm. So he was really my first mentor. His name was Ned Frederick. He was one of those polymaths who was equally good at science. He had a degree in biomechanics, but in business, and also he had a sharp eye for design. So as a small consultancy, it was a great place to cut my teeth and learn about footwear. But how I got to footwear is total chance. It came from a phone call as I was heading out the door at Continuum, a phone call about they needed someone to do some consulting work to create a 3D model of an articulated foot.
Okay.
And for testing purposes. And on my way out the door, they said, hey, if you're looking for some work ahead, why don't you tap this guy? So that led to a job that led to work. Our first footwear clients were Oslo out of Italy, part of Benetton Sports Systems. And then we began to work with Converse, and eventually Converse liked both Exeter Research and the people who worked there enough to say, we would simply like to buy you and have you come in-house. So I spent about a year at Converse and realized I really didn't enjoy designing sports shoes. It was okay, but it was a lot more fashion and flash and not so much about real problem solving. The problem was visual, I would say.
Yeah.
So I got a call from a friend of mine saying, you know, Timberland is growing. We're right next door to where you live. We're looking for some designers who have kind of experience in biomechanics, how the foot moves, and hard science, you might say. And would you be interested in interviewing? So in 98, I joined the Timberland company and spent 21 years there. There we go.
That's amazing.
Well, it's an anomaly these days to spend that much time. But I'll tell you about it as we get there. So you asked me one question. Sorry.
No, that was perfect. That was perfect. I love that. And it's really important to the story. So thanks for going through that. So I guess that sort of answers also, you know, the question around why did you go into design and, you know, what you went to school for. But yeah, can you talk a little bit about your career path and after you started at Timberland, kind of how your career evolved from there?
Sure. I was hired in 1998 at Timberland when it was still a family-owned company. It was publicly traded, but the Schwartz family that began Timberland was transitioned between the man who founded it, Sidney Schwartz. He founded it in 1974. It was transitioning leadership to his son, Jeff.
Okay.
I joined Timberland when it was still a family-owned company, when personality and who sat upstairs in the office was really important. The Schwartz family lived and breathed shoes. Jeffrey told me one time, he said, yeah, our vacations, we used to go to Fanny in New York. That was a vacation. And Timberland was not so far away from its roots, its beginnings in Newmarket, New Hampshire, the town I live in now. It started in a mill that dates back to the 1700s. It's built along a river for mill power, water power. And they started in that mill in 1974 and employed local townspeople. It was a simple but bold idea at that time. It was about getting the job done. It was about being smart. It was about being inventive, about Yankee ingenuity. It was sometimes about breaking rules, just saying, how do we get there?
Yeah.
So I began at Timberland as, they didn't call me a junior designer, but that's probably what my job title was. And I was on what was called the boots category at that time. And I helped launch a sub-brand for Timberland called Pro. And Timberland Pro has grown into a large business. At that time, it was an acknowledgement that Timberland had started out by making waterproof work boots. But the nature of work had changed a lot in 25 years. And they recognized they needed to reinvent footwear for people who worked outside construction or whatnot for a living. So I began in my first year helping to launch that brand.
Okay.
What it was going to do, how it was going to perform in a flat market where the only way to grow was to steal, take away shelf space from the likes of Red Wing or Wolverine or whoever else was playing there. But I was also put on the boots team and given the job of creating market-appropriate colorways for some of their icons. And so my job at the very beginning was to figure out, well, if we're going to color this 6-inch boot or this field boot, what color should we do?
Yeah.
Figure it out. And this was before cell phones. This digital cameras were just coming on. And I took the problem on as sort of a left brain, how do we do this problem? How do I figure this out? And so I would go to New York City and I would spend a week there. I had subway tokens, a paper map, street map, a list of contacts and stores that I had amassed over a series of trips. And I printed them out so they would fit on these little pieces of paper I could slip into my pocket. And I had a Pantone fan and a notebook and a backpack. And at the beginning of the week, I'd start on Canal Street at the very lower end of Manhattan. And a week later, I would end up on 125th Street or sometimes up in the Bronx. So way at the top of Manhattan. And what I would do is I would seek out usually it was the buyers in an independent shoe store like Jimmy Jazz or David Z's or some of the other players in the market then. And I'd find that person who actually had their finger on the pulse of what was going on. And that person was usually a kid who had worked as a sales associate, but who moved up through the ranks quickly and shown that they knew what was what.
Yeah.
So I'd find that person. And and I would say, hard to believe, but I'm the white guy from New Hampshire at Timberland who's trying to figure out
what color?
What colors you would like to purchase from us in a year. So give me a little help. But instead of laughing at me, people were thrilled. They're like, great.
Yeah.
I'd love to tell you all about it. Let me show you why powder blue, Tar Heels blue and white is going to be the next big thing. Because it's going to hook up exactly with this top, this jersey. This is what's coming on. And so after a week of doing this, I'd have a really strong sense of what we should do. And it worked beautifully for a long time because the trend cycles were still slow enough. This was pre-internet, you might say. Trend cycles were slow enough that you could catch the wave, as it were.
Yeah.
Even with a lead time on your product of 13, 14 months, you
could
still get your product out in the market and be on trend or sometimes anticipate the trend. So it worked out wonderfully. It was great fun. I'll add one anecdote. So we had a shoe called the Field Boot, and it had originally been a hunting boot, and it was a chukka height, and it was probably the closest thing we had to call it a high top basketball shoe. It sort of felt the same. It was more comfortable. It had a padded collar. It wasn't a tall boot, and it lent itself to two color colorways. So let's call it a base color and a secondary color. And I began putting these out there. And then I found out that people were giving them nicknames. And all the nicknames were food. So the very first one I did, it was a wheat color leather with a khaki colored panel. And it was nicknamed the Mac and Cheese.
That's awesome.
Then the next one, a brown and green, was the beef and broccoli. And it went on. The blackberry, the blueberry, the shark fin soup. There were dozens of them. And I finally, it was ingenious, which is, you know, if you said, yeah, I like that khaki and tan shoe, it's not very descriptive and it's not very, I don't know, doesn't engage the senses.
Yeah.
But to say, yeah, I like the mac and cheese, that conjures up a lot. So I give credit to whoever came up with this at the beginning. And in fact, I asked a buyer at Jimmy Jazz, I said, how does this happen? I said, I'm mystified. I love it. But how does a name is adopted? And he told me this story. He said, well, there are these two kids in Co-op City up in the Bronx. He just said, like, they're the influencers.
Yeah.
Before the word influencer was really an idea. And whenever a new boot would come out, it was sort of a contest. Each of them would throw out a name. And over the course of a couple of weeks, one would gain consensus, and that was the name. And then that name would spread from New York to Philadelphia to Baltimore, Washington, all the way out to Chicago. And it was really kind of fun. So it came down to two kids in Co-op City floating food names out there.
I love it.
The cool thing is the first two colorways, the beef and broccoli and the mac and cheese, 20 something years later, are still being sold. People still buy them and seek them out.
That's amazing.
So you asked me a question about how my career progressed to Timberland. So I started out doing a certain amount of performance problem solving by helping to launch the Pro label. But a majority of my work was around what we called leather lines and last. So
Okay. What
was the material in the shoe? What was the pattern? What was the shape? In other words, primarily what I was doing were styling exercises.
Right.
And it was a fun problem to solve, and you can solve it over and over and over. And it involves a lot, you know, involves understanding your customer, understanding trends in the world, being able to see a little further ahead than most people, working with materials vendors to get the colors developed that you need. It was a good problem, but eventually I started getting bored with it. I don't know, somewhere around my 400th pattern. It just began to feel like rinse and repeat in the shower. Just do it again, Sam. But I mentioned that the Timberland company was majority owned by a family, the Schwartz family. And they weren't just business people. They had and have a strong moral compass about doing good in the world. And when Jeffrey, the son, took over leadership of the company, when he became president of the company, he wanted to put that into practice, not just in his personal life, but within this business.
Yeah.
But Jeff, a few years into his leadership, asked what was kind of an obvious question. It was the elephant in the room. Okay, we're doing good in the world in our communities, but Timberland sells stuff. We put things out in the world. And we can pat ourselves on the back and saying we provide people with gear that equips them to get outside and enjoy the natural world. But what are we doing with respect to the impact of our product on the planet?
Right.
It's a question that's obvious as soon as you ask it. We sell stuff. What are we doing? What's our responsibility here? And that was the germ, the beginning thought around an initiative they began in 2008 called Earthkeepers. The question Jeff would answer to Wall Street every quarter during the earnings call was, how do we do well and do good? And his argument, made eloquently over and over and over, was that doing good helps you do well. In other words, what's good for the world can be good for business. His job was to demonstrate quantitatively how that was true. Sounds nice, and intuitively people think, yeah, if you have a good brand, your reputation, that helps your bottom line, but show us. And Wall Street analysts are tough. They ask hard questions, and he was the right person to answer that. He was always the smartest man in the room, or smartest man on the call, you might say. So the timing was perfect. I was raised by Unitarians. I was the son of a scientist. We recycled at a time when you had to bring your recycling stuff to the dump. It wasn't picked up at the curb. The science emerging around climate change and CO2 is really becoming clear at this point. And I needed to solve a problem more meaningful than how to sell more shoes to people who wanted to buy those shoes from us.
Right.
So the question of how do you make product that is better for the planet was a really good question. Yeah. And it was a point in my career when I had learned enough about shoemaking by spending time in factories, by just being curious, by asking questions.
Right.
And being at an age where I wanted to make a bigger dent in the world than just having a shoe named after food that I created. So my point is, it was as Steven Johnson quotes in his book, How We Got to Now, and also another book on design, it's called The Adjacent Possible. So the idea is quite simple, which is timing is everything. There's no point in creating a computer in the 19th century when nobody knows what to do with it. And likewise with something like a sustainability initiative at a footwear brand. The timing in the world was right for this. The right people were in charge of the company. They lived and breathed footwear, and they had a moral compass. And for me personally, I was at a point in my career and had some of the background training in science and how to think critically, that I was a good candidate for helping them solve the problem of better footwear in the world. And that was the start of Earthkeepers.
That's awesome. I remember I actually started in the industry in 2008.
Oh,
and
great.
I remember my very first project was at Montrail, and we were working on a eco-sustainable, but the first stab at it. But I loved it. And I remember looking at Earthkeepers and being like, someone else is doing it. You know, you could feel the momentum at the time, but Earthkeepers was definitely the guiding light on that. Like, you guys were leading with that cause, and it was interesting.
At that time, I'd like to think that we were leading. Jeffrey pointed out a very good point about Earthkeepers. And his point was this: Earthkeepers, its very presence posed a question from consumers to the industry. And the question was, if Timberland can do it, where's your boot? Where's your shoe? Why can't you do it? It was a bit like the Prius. It wasn't a perfect answer, but once Toyota established that, no, electric or hybrid cars aren't a commercial flop, they actually can be something people want to buy and they work well. As soon as they prove that, I'd argue that they help pave the way for the likes of Tesla. I've said many times, I think Elon Musk owes a Christmas card to Toyota. More than one.
Yeah.
But Timberland went a little further. They put on what was called a nutrition label on their Earthkeepers products. And it was modeled after food nutrition labels. But instead of carbohydrates and proteins and so forth, it was about water use and CO2 use. And it gave it a score. And Jeff said, you know, we're going to put it out there, the good and the bad.
Yeah.
But that likes pose this question, if Timberland can do it, why can't you?
Yeah.
And in that sense, far beyond the CO2 savings or the plastic reuse in some of our early products, far beyond the impact that had, it was an outsized impact on the world of footwear and beyond into apparel of changing the conversation, changing the question from is eco even worth pursuing to the question of how are we going to do this?
Totally. We should be required to put that label on everything.
Yes. You are talking to a self-described fanatic on the issue at this point. And I was on a call at 6 a.m. this morning talking to an Italian supplier of Strobel sock material that's made out of Tencel and PLA, and questioning him on the aspect of benignness. It's an idea around, will this material cause any harm to the planet in its next life? That's the stuff I live and breathe now.
Awesome. What a great mission.
Well, it's, you know, when you have children,
yeah,
your priorities change. You start thinking well beyond your own, I don't know, lifestyle and standard of living, and you start thinking about the future and what it holds for your children. What world will they inherit? And probably the question that always drives me forward, keeps me up at night, is not so much a question as a challenge to myself, that I do not want to have to apologize to my children or my grandchildren in 30 years and saying, when they ask me, why is the world such a mess? Why didn't you do something about this? I don't want to be in that position where I say, yeah, you know, we just ignored the problem. Have fun. Good luck.
Totally.
Yeah. It's actually, without leaping ahead too far, I would say this current year, right here in 2020, it's an overused phrase, but, you know, there's no opportunity like a crisis. It's absolutely true. When everything gets thrown up in the air,
yeah,
then things can be done differently. There is a chance before they settle back into round pegs and round holes and square pegs and square holes to rethink things. And so, you know, the upheaval that online retail has exacted on the industry, but COVID as a, call it a stress test as to the validity of your business. But also, I would, without going political here, I would argue there's nothing like an adversary to inspire people to stop talking and start moving. I'll leave it at that. But I would argue that 2020 and beyond is a crossing point of a series of circumstances and, you might say, kind of a setup to do better. This is exactly the time right now for companies, whether they're new or existing, to be able to reevaluate and retool and rethink, and not just in incremental sense, but as a paradigm shift, how to move from linear extractive economy to a fully circular, no such thing as trash, waste is the next treasure way of thinking.
Oh, I love that. It's exciting. It's an exciting opportunity and an imperative opportunity, I guess.
Yeah, sure thing. So I've taken this off script, and I want to put the steering wheel back in your hands. So.
No. So I guess, so you started working on Earth Keepers, and what did you learn from that drove you to where you are now?
I started on Earth Keepers designing a few shoes, and that grew into a collection, which grew into a category, which grew into a company standard around what it made. I got to grow as it grew, because of course the problem changes dramatically from a shoe to a category to a brand.
Right.
But one of the things I learned early on was the power of a meaningful point of difference in the market to be able to make even what seem now humble claims around sustainability were at that time powerful, powerful features and benefits, we'll say, on a shoe. They gave marketing something to work with. And you found when you created compelling designs that told the story well, even in a self-evident manner, and I would argue the best design is self-evident. It talks about itself. You don't need a hang tag to explain it. When you deliver a product that does more than persuade people on the level of style or fashion, you find that it allows everyone else to do their job better as well. So by everyone else, I mean marketing or finance or development or sourcing or supply chain. They all have a North Star to work towards.
Totally.
And while on the one hand, it gives them a clear directive, something quantitative, like we are going for a shoe with 50% recycled content and made with gold-rated leather. That's
right.
Those are marching orders. But I also found that people, no matter who they were, you know, the head of sourcing, for Timberland seemed like a pretty nuts and bolts, dry, just give me the facts, ma'am, sort of person. But I found no matter who it was, this gave them something to be personally invested in. It gave them a reason beyond a paycheck to get up and work harder and pursue excellence. It was an incredible motivator. I found in the hard work of working with a vendor to create a better textile or whatnot, I found instead of having to bully them into doing the right thing.
Yeah.
I found that people wanted to do it. They're like, right. Great. Yeah. And so much of the time, despite everything we may think about business and corporate, so much success ends up relying on human to human and a person you're talking to believing with their heart in what you're after and going the extra mile on their part to deliver. So one of the first lessons I learned at Earth Keepers is when you're involved in something worthy, the wind is at your back. It helps tremendously. People can believe a lot more deeply in making the world a better place than they can in selling more blue shoes.
Totally.
I mean, there are myriad lessons from Earth Keepers, everything from how do you deal with complex problems? So what are your goals? Is it carbon footprint? Is it reduction of trash? Is it giving our natural resources a break? And you have to be clear, because if you try to pursue two or three things at once, you end up in analysis paralysis. It is very difficult. And so in Earth Keepers, I had to learn how to organize thinking around what we were trying to solve so that we didn't get caught trying to compare apples to oranges while we're loading a freight car with kumquats, as it were. So it required a lot of clear thinking prior to putting pen to paper to go into creative mode, you might say. And I love that as much as any person. I can immerse myself for days using, you know, a pad of sketch paper and pencils and surrounding myself with images from the market that inspire me and just play. I mean, that's why I got into design, because I love living in my own head that way.
I love how you put that.
I mean, most designers are introverts by nature. they got good at art because they probably weren't very good at math or something else. So Earthkeepers also taught me about the limits of incremental improvement. What I mean by that is, if you come out with a shoe that for the first time shows 50% recycled PET in its lining, that's a big deal. It's still sort of a big deal when a year later you push it to 62. At some point, you start to hit a ceiling limit on technically what's possible. I don't know, 85%. And then you manage to push it to 86. And everybody internally is like, wow, we did it. But your customer doesn't care. That is stop being meaningful to them. That is so old news. And in fact, for the most part, people have no idea why that matters. Why would 2 percentage point matters? You can attempt to tell them about it, but you have to explain it to them. It doesn't simply resonate. The product doesn't explain why this is better. So I learned that there was a limit to how far we were going to go telling a story about just how the shoe was made, what it was made of, how it was a little better than last year's model. Eventually, that was not going to be a powerful enough solution. So.
Well, that might be a really good transition into what you're doing now and the powerful solution you're creating.
Sure. I left Timberland in 2020. After more than 2 decades there, I outgrew the company, and the company had been acquired by a much larger company, VF, that owns Vans and North Face. The priorities were different, being diplomatic here. And I found at my age with my career experience, I felt like I had more to share than I was able to at Timberland, both in an educational aspect, but I also had where I wanted to achieve. And an aspect of large organizations is that you are pegged into a role, and don't play in other people's sandboxes. You get your hands slapped a lot. But I also found that the only way to deliver really powerful design is to move beyond just drawing pretty pictures, but asking questions and advocating in all different sorts of areas. So if you're going to build the next great shoe, you probably need to know a lot about shoe fabrication. Know enough to ask a question in factory of like, what does this machine do? And then make the leap of like, oh, wow, in a different context, that could help us. And if you are being constantly set back in your chair in front of your laptop and say, no, we just would like you to draw, please, it limits you. And yeah. I'm not saying Timberland was a great company and continues to be so. They push hard. But I found, the best way to put it is I found I outgrew my role there. And I wanted to do more in the world. And I felt ready to. I felt like I knew enough to do something really bold. So I left Timberland, took a year off, and did a lot of things. I was far busier than I ever thought I was going to be, but I ended up doing public speaking around the topic of design and the next wave of sustainability, kind of a term I came up with, you might say, but next wave being extending responsibility and consideration beyond the point of sale of your product. I recognize that that's where that was the next frontier. That was the next big work that needed to be done. That was the cliff that everybody ran up to and then stopped at. What happens to your shoes after you sell them to somebody? It's what I call the trash can moment, when the shoes are totally, you can't use them anymore and there's no way to fix them. And you are holding by the shoelaces over a trash can saying, I don't know what else to do here. Oh, well. And you drop them in. Nobody was addressing that. Not really. So I had it the most fortuitous of, I don't know, it was the most unlikeliest chance, the most unlikeliest situation that in March of last year, I got a call from Jeffrey Schwartz, who's long retired, had other things in the world he was doing. And he said, hey, as much as I've tried to raise my children so they would never, ever go into the shoe business, I have failed with one. And he and I would like to talk to you because he has an insight into the world of footwear and has a conviction on what's next. Would you like to talk to us? So I traveled down to Boston, met with him at Harvard, and had an hour-long conversation. And out of that conversation began to work with the company that is now called Arum. And I can tell you more about that brand at a later point, but suffice to say that Arum is a very different proposition to footwear. First off, its occasion use is the desert. And as Noah Schwartz, third generation of shoemakers from the Schwartz family, has so aptly pointed out, that in the world of outdoor footwear, everything you'll find is dedicated to either wet or cold. Nobody really designs product for hot and dry. And yet, the deserts are some of the most interesting, compelling places you'd ever hope to visit. There's a big white space out there. I want to fill it, but not just with your lick and stick, typical Asia-made footwear that is going to wear out and trash the planet. I think it's probably in the DNA of his family. He wanted to take doing well and doing good into the 21st century. What does that mean today? And so the design ask of me was create commercial, feasible, compelling line of footwear that is priced right, that performs beautifully, that is engineered for use in the desert. And, oh, by the way, we're going to make this thing entirely circular. And we are going to, at every point, look to avoid plastics and embrace natural materials. And we are going to take these shoes back and stream them on responsibly. So make sure you build it so it can come apart. Make sure you build it out of things that have a next life use. And we even want to account for the fact that not everybody, no matter how easy we make it for them, is going to do the right thing and return the shoes to us. Some people are going to inevitably throw their shoes out their car window. And yet, we want to take responsibility for those shoes that end up in the environment in an unplanned manner. And we want to make sure that they, at the very least, do no harm. So, sounds clear and easy. but the challenge, let's just say, to my knowledge, it hasn't been done before.
Well, I guess that's kind of a good segue into one of my last questions. What does success look like to you? I think personally, because you
personally,
talked a little bit about what success is for the brand.
Oh, personally, as a footwear designer, or personally in the monstrously huge picture?
Whichever one you want to touch on.
Ouch. I have this problem of focus. It's both a problem and a boon. I can tunnel vision down on a problem, just pick at it like a computer virus trying to hack into a mainframe, and it serves me well. But sometimes it takes a moment to shake my head and pull out and go, oh, right. Oh, it's Tuesday and it's lunchtime. And talk to my family and they'll with a grimace agree with you. But to try to answer your question, I think like a lot of people in this world today who find meaning in their work, it is hard to disentangle my professional aspirations from my personal ones at this It consumes half of my waking hours every day. Yeah. It's hard for it not to be important. I'm lucky in that my professional aspirations can align so strongly with my personal ones. And my personal ones have everything to do with the people I love in this world and the planet that I love. I grew up, my nickname as a kid was Nature Boy. I just, if you'd come across me at 5 years old, I lived in Houston, I'd be running around barefoot with a butterfly net trying to catch cicadas. That's what I did.
That's awesome.
So I love nature. And that sounds like, well, duh, who doesn't? But I mean, it's my father, the scientist, taught me just how wondrous, how incredibly beautiful and powerful and interesting and monumental the natural world is. And I try to turn my, instead of giving into sort of the tenor of our times where we go, man, we are just screwing this up. Our democracy is in trouble. Our planet's in trouble. Everything sucks. Instead of going that route, I think to myself, I'm at a pivotal point in history, given an opportunity by a bold, brilliant next generation of shoemakers in the world to go out and put my convictions into action to make the world a better place. There's the professional part, right? So that my children and the other people I love, but I'll use my children as a stand-in for humanity for a minute, so that my children have a future on this planet that is defined more by brightness and wonderfulness than it is by difficulty and hardship or diminishing everything. So what does success look like to me in that regard? Success to me comes back to some things I've already told you, which is the project I'm involved in, the company that I'm a part of now, Arum, our product that we put out there, my aim, success, is that it resets the conversation in the footwear industry around what's possible and what the future is in the things that we make and sell and use and ultimately have to find a home for. And I'd like to think that extends further out than footwear into apparel and other things. I restrain myself by, before I get too far ahead of myself and think, yeah, I'm going to change the world. No, I don't. I'm not that smart. But I do recognize an opportunity that right now, right here, people are asking for answers. Answers to things they can't solve themselves. And that if I present one answer, a small one, albeit maybe 50,000 pairs of shoes out in the world, that the influence of that across other companies, across the industry, across maybe multiple industries,
yeah,
is so, so much bigger that it has a what I call an outsized influence. And that maybe just like Greta, how do you pronounce her name?
I think it's Greta Thunberg.
Yeah. So just like Greta Thunberg, right person, right time with the right message. One person had a huge outsized influence, was an inspiration. I don't claim to be an inspiration, but I hope that the products we put out there will be. And so success for me would be, yeah, they help change the world.
I think that's an amazing goal. And I think that, I mean, I'm so inspired just having listened to this. And I think that what you're doing is kind of combining the art and science worlds into something that is consumer appropriate and consumer centric. And I think that is something that's so important because it's bringing that message directly to the consumer, as opposed to sort of other forms of information that maybe aren't as impactful as the thing that you wear every day. And so I think it's an incredible, valuable mission. I think there's other companies that are doing things that are trying to improve the environment. And I think that your take on that is even more realized and profound. So I really hope that other people can take this and be inspired and try to do something, even that next step at the company that they're at.
Oh, I hope so. Nothing would please me more than to have to chase after somebody that leapfrogged us.
Yeah.
And got even further ahead. Yes, please bring it on. Yeah. Yeah, there's nothing more that I could say than that. Wholeheartedly agree.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. I am incredibly inspired, and I, you know, this is something that I've been thinking a lot about, especially having had a child myself. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, obviously it's something that's always been important to me, but not something that I have prioritized in ways that I'm proud of. And I think hearing you speak and hearing about the brand, it just, I think more people need to hear this message. So thank you so much for your time and for coming on. And I really, really enjoyed this.
Christina, of course, you're making a difference with this project right here with your podcast. No, I mean, we all find a way, right?
Yeah.
I'm glad to help.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. And
You are welcome. Be well. Stay safe.
Okay? You too. You too. Bye. Thank you.
Thank you so much to Pete for joining me on the show. Your passion for sustainability is contagious, and I so appreciate you sharing your knowledge to inspire us all. Check out our Instagram for some additional images from today's discussion, and make sure to come back for part two to hear some incredibly exciting insights into the next wave of sustainable design. Thanks for listening to the Save As podcast. To help us get off the ground, we would love for you to subscribe, leave a rating or comment, and tell a friend. We would also love to collaborate with you. Who would you like to hear on the show? Please DM us and let us know.